KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
From a quarantine studio brought to you by KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. In today's news headlines, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders has dropped out of the presidential race, making an announcement on Wednesday morning.
I could give you better news, but I think you know the truth. And that is that we are now some 300 delegates behind Vice President Biden, and the path toward victory is virtually impossible. So while we are winning the ideological battle, and while we are winning the support of so many young people and working people throughout the country, I have concluded that this battle for the Democratic nomination will not be successful.
That's Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders ending his presidential race on Wednesday morning. It was Sanders' second bid for the presidency, and his withdrawal from the race now clears the path for former Vice President Joe Biden to claim the Democratic nomination. Sanders said the movement that his campaign helped to coalesce around would continue and that he would remain on the ballot and gather delegates in order to influence the Democratic Party platform. Writing an op-ed in the Guardian newspaper on the same day, Sanders laid out a plan for how the nation ought to tackle the coronavirus pandemic that has now impacted almost the entire globe. He wrote that Congress must lead the way because, quote, President Trump is incapable of providing leadership and instead continues to mislead the public and act out of political self-interest. Sanders endorsed a $2,000 monthly payment to every American, guaranteed paid medical and sick leave, and eviction moratoriums. Sanders' policy ideas have become mainstream during the pandemic, even as his candidacy comes to an end. Meanwhile, Mr. Biden described in an interview on CNN the details of a conversation that he had with Trump about the coronavirus, describing the president as, quote, gracious.
He asked whether or not we would not discuss the detail of what we talked about, just say that we had a good conversation. He was very gracious in his conversation.
That's Joe Biden discussing a phone call that he had with Trump. Biden is expected to emerge the victor in Tuesday's primary elections in Wisconsin, which were held over great controversy. After Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers postponed the election by executive order, his state's Supreme Court overturned it by a partisan vote of 5-4, forcing the election to commence on Tuesday in spite of the coronavirus lockdown. The resulting election was marred by low turnout as Wisconsinites were forced to choose between risking their health and exercising their right to vote. In densely populated cities like Milwaukee, only a handful of polling places were even open, forcing many to wait for hours in line, wearing masks and other protective gear in order to cast ballots. The decision to move ahead with voting disproportionately impacted Black voters. Republicans saw a political advantage to preserving the election schedule in order to retain a crucial conservative seat on the state Supreme Court. The Republican-dominated state legislature in Wisconsin refused Democratic demands to send mail-in ballots to all voters, and this week President Trump jumped into the fray, exhorting his fellow Republicans to fight against vote-by-mail elections. During a critical election year that is marred by a pandemic, Trump said out loud the words that most have attributed as an ulterior motive for the GOP's reluctance to make voting easier. He said, quote, Republicans should fight very hard when it comes to statewide mail-in voting. Democrats are clamoring for it. Tremendous potential for voter fraud and, for whatever reason, doesn't work out well for Republicans. During the Coronavirus Task Force press briefing on Tuesday evening, Trump said, mail-in voting is horrible. It's corrupt. When he was asked by a reporter why he mailed in his own ballot, he did not see the irony.
Voting is horrible.
But you voted by
it's
mail
corrupt.
In Florida's election last month, didn't you?
Sure, I could vote by mail for that.
How do you reconcile
because I'm
that?
Allowed to. Well, that's called out of state. You know why I voted? Because I happen to be in the White House and I won't be able to go to Florida to vote. And you get thousands and thousands of people sitting in somebody's living room signing ballots all over the place. No, I think that mail-in voting is a terrible thing.
That's President Trump claiming without evidence that vote-by-mail elections are fraud-ridden. As the coronavirus continues its grim toll across the world, the hardest-hit U.S. state of New York lost nearly 800 people in a single day, and nationwide the number of deaths neared 2,000 over 24 hours. Surpassing all other nations, the U.S. now has 400,000 confirmed infections. Demographics of those most impacted reveal that Black Americans are disproportionately impacted by the virus. In several counties and states, Black Americans comprise 70% of deaths. According to a Washington Post analysis, counties that are majority Black have three times the rate of infections and almost six times the rate of deaths as counties where white residents are in the majority. U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams acknowledged the statistics, saying this in an interview on CBS.
And I've shared myself personally that I have high blood pressure, that I have heart disease and spent a week in the ICU due to a heart condition, that I actually have asthma and I'm pre-diabetic. And so I represent that legacy of growing up poor and Black in America, and I and many Black Americans are at higher risk for COVID. It's why we need everyone to do their part to slow the spread.
That's Surgeon General Jerome Adams. Meanwhile, the virus continues its spread, with Cook County Jail in Chicago, Illinois, the largest jail in the nation, emerging as a new epicenter of the disease. More than 350 cases of virus infections are linked to the jail as protesters gathered outside demanding that people be released to avoid a full-scale public health catastrophe. More evidence is emerging of how much the Trump administration knew about the danger of coronavirus months earlier. ABC News reported that as far back as last November, U.S. intelligence officials warned about the potential of the virus emerging in China as, quote, a cataclysmic event. And memos from Trump's top trade advisor, Peter Navarro, became public this week, showing that the president was briefed on the virus in the starkest terms in late January. Mr. Navarro's memo said the lack of immune protection or an existing cure or vaccine would leave Americans defenseless in the case of a full-blown coronavirus outbreak on U.S. soil. This lack of protection elevates the risk of the coronavirus evolving into a full-blown pandemic, imperiling the lives of millions of Americans. End of quote. Dr. Deborah Birx, who is on the White House Coronavirus Task Force, has said she is seeing some positive indicators that quarantine measures are working, but she warned Americans against resuming normal business and triggering a second wave of infections. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, meanwhile, is apparently considering a proposal allowing those who've been exposed to someone with the virus but are not showing symptoms to potentially return to work. Meanwhile, Democrats are considering a new wave of economic relief for Americans, including greater funding for food stamps and hospitals. The news comes as Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin has requested an additional $250 billion for small business loans after the initial fund was inundated with applications. And President Trump has removed the safeguards that Congress had put in place to oversee the dispensing of an emergency fund for big businesses. Finally, the lockdown of the Chinese city of Wuhan, where the coronavirus was first discovered, has officially ended. The ending of the 76-day mandatory quarantine was met with celebrations by the city's residents as air travel and public transportation resumed. There were no new cases of the virus in Wuhan this week. And that does it for our news headlines today. We'll be back with the rest of the show after this break. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The Wisconsin Supreme Court this week voted to overturn Governor Tony Evers' executive order to postpone Tuesday's primary election over the coronavirus pandemic. The U.S. Supreme Court then ruled 5-4 that the thousands of people who had requested absentee ballots in Wisconsin but never received them would have to show up in person to vote in spite of the health risks. Voters lined up for hours facing closed polling places and even rain and hail. At stake for Republicans is a state Supreme Court seat currently held by a conservative facing a liberal challenger. The decision to move ahead with the election on Tuesday forced Wisconsin's voters to pit their own health against their right to vote, foreshadowing what could transpire in the general election this November. While Democrats have pushed for an expansion of vote by mail, President Donald Trump has openly called on his party to fight the move, saying Republicans don't benefit from mail-in ballots. My guest is Jeff Milchen. He's an organizer, speaker, and writer, and founder of Reclaim Democracy. And he recently wrote an article called Dying to Vote and a Warning for November. Welcome to the program, Jeff.
Thanks for having me.
So can you explain what exactly happened? How is it that the Supreme Court got involved? I understand that the state-level Supreme Court in Wisconsin initially overturned the governor's order that was made on Monday?
Right. So there were two separate Supreme Court decisions on the eve of the election, one at the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And what they ruled was that the governor's order to stop the election the day before the election because of the public health crisis was unconstitutional, according to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. So they stopped the election from being postponed until June, which was what Governor Evers planned to do. In a separate ruling soon afterward, the U.S. Supreme Court said that a plan to allow an extra week for absentee ballots to be mailed and counted was unconstitutional. The reason for that action by the state was that because of the flood of individual requests for absentee ballots, for obvious reasons, they couldn't keep up with the demand, and thousands of people still did not have an absentee ballot on the eve of the election. So obviously it would be impossible for many of them to have the ballot postmarked by election day if they didn't even have a ballot in their hands. The U.S. Supreme Court struck down that action as well, and that's what caused the real fiasco in Green Bay and Milwaukee and many other cities, with people having no choice but to either sacrifice their vote or go join mobs of people and wait for hours, often in some horrendous weather, to exercise their right to vote.
So I understand that there were people who had initially requested, or weeks earlier had requested, absentee ballots that then waited and waited for those ballots to arrive and didn't get them. Is that true? And if so, how widespread a problem was this? And did that simply mean that a voter going in person would have been able to cast their ballot successfully?
Yes. So according to the state, there were at least 9,000 ballots that were not mailed out as of the day before Election Day. So at least that many people would not have received their ballot, probably significantly more. And that included Milwaukee city officials, even a woman who wouldn't have been able to vote for her own election for her race. So that created, the mobs of people, many who obviously would not be able to wait in line for hours, and certainly disenfranchised at least tens of thousands of people. The voting turnout in Milwaukee was about one-tenth of the normal number.
Wow. So I understand that in some very densely populated areas like Milwaukee, instead of 180 polling places, which is the normal number, there were only 4 that were open. Why is that?
Yes. I heard reports there were 5 out of 180 open, but absolutely the same point applies. That was largely because, understandably, a lot of poll workers decided that risking their lives to make a few bucks in extra pocket money was probably not a trade-off they were willing to make. So rather than having an opportunity to go to smaller neighborhood polling precincts, people were forced to join absolute mobs at just five precincts around the city of Milwaukee, five polling places. And a very similar situation was occurring up in Green Bay. So it turned what was already a horrible situation into an even worse one, where maintaining, you know, safe distancing was almost an impossibility under those circumstances.
Obviously, I can imagine that such a that an election going forward in such a manner, in particular, might disenfranchise elderly voters, disabled voters, people for people with the underlying health conditions that are being told are most vulnerable to this disease and need to shelter in place, in a manner that's much more serious.
Certainly, it absolutely is disenfranchising the most vulnerable in society. And, you know, it's certainly no coincidence that, in my view, when we see these efforts that are especially impacting the urban centers, the more densely populated areas, those that also tend to be the most heavily populated by minorities. In the case of Milwaukee, Blacks far outnumber whites in the city, and an additional 18% of the population is Hispanic. So about 60% of the population is minority in Milwaukee. And you think about what would have happened if the situation was reversed, and instead of Milwaukee and Green Bay, it was 180 polling locations shut down around the rural areas of northern Wisconsin. We simply don't see that. It's a very deliberate disenfranchisement strategy on the part of the Republican Party.
Was it clear to you that what was really at stake for the conservatives, both at the state level and potentially even at the federal Supreme Court level, that there was an interest in seeing a single seat held by a conservative and being challenged by a liberal on the state Supreme Court be preserved, that this was something that Republicans were relying on? I mean, of course, it's not necessarily clear if the federal Supreme Court justices would have necessarily been moved by the same concerns that state-level Republicans would be moved by. But it certainly seemed as though the Republicans and the conservatives aligned in their own interest.
Certainly. You know, there's currently a 4-2 majority on the part of conservative justices on the state Supreme Court of Wisconsin. One of those seats was up for election. And it was a very expected to be a very tightly contested race. That may or may not be the case when we see the results now expected to come out on Monday. There's a whole cycle going on here. Wisconsin has some of the most extreme gerrymandering of any state in the union, so that even though Democrats received an overwhelming majority of the votes in the last election cycle, the Republicans hold the majority in the state legislature because they succeeded in packing so much of the Democratic vote into very few precincts and distorted the outcome of the results that way. So they are dependent on that Supreme Court majority now to keep those gerrymandered districts in place rather than overturning them, which is likely to happen if there were a shift in the balance of the state Supreme Court. So there's a whole cycle of disenfranchisement, voter suppression, and partisan advantage here that's in play.
So in order to preserve the unfair advantage that Republicans were enjoying in Wisconsin, they used more unfair means to insist on voting on Tuesday and thereby likely ensuring that they preserved that advantage. Essentially, voter suppression begets gerrymandering.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, at the U.S. Supreme Court, the partisanship was pretty naked. Their ruling said that because extending the date by which absentee ballots could be received, that would, quote, fundamentally alter the nature of the election too close to election day. So their
decision to void absentee ballots was basically based on the effectiveness of absentee ballots.
Right. And meanwhile, they did not address at all the situation going on in many of the cities in Wisconsin of massive disenfranchisement because of the lack of available polling places. That was not, in their view, something that would rise to the level of impacting altering the nature of the election in a fundamental way.
And President Donald Trump has been saying as much out loud as well in what may have, you know, that essentially echoing what the Supreme Court justices who voted to void the absentee ballot said. He has railed against mail-in balloting, voting by mail, and essentially openly said, for whatever reasons, Republicans don't do well when there is voting by mail. And when he was asked this week why voting by mail was, in his words, so corrupt, given that he himself had mailed in his own ballot, because now his home state is Florida, he said, of course he would do so, because that's his right to do so. And he just saw no irony in him condemning other people's right to vote by mail.
Right. It's interesting in that there's really scant evidence that it actually would advantage Democrats to have universal mail-in voting. In fact, in Wisconsin, the early results from mail-in appeared to be much more heavily weighted on the Republican side. So there's no question his intentions are bad, but in this case, his focus may not be actually helpful for the Republican Party.
So this is, you know, such a bizarre situation that we have today. The idea of an election moving forward in spite of a pandemic to further this naked partisanship and having that reflected at the federal level, it seems as though Republicans feel that the only way they can remain in power is by reducing access to voting. I mean, Trump in his remarks to reporters invoked, you know, and he does this so effectively because he's so good at manipulating people, he invoked this image of people sitting in their living room filling out thousands and thousands of ballots, basically implying that they're sitting there rigging elections by the thousands. But somehow his own mail-in ballot, which was properly certified and sealed, was legitimate, but other people were apparently getting away with filling out thousands and thousands of ballots. There's no such evidence suggesting that anyone's ever done this, right?
Or it's pure fiction. And you know, certainly it would be nice if the media simply refused to carry those kind of remarks from Donald Trump on air. It's an absolute disgrace that the major broadcasting networks continue to give him a live microphone and camera to spew lies that are not fact-checked in real time. That's something that, you know, there's certainly been a lot of discussion around the country, and I think a few networks have started pulling back on that. But it's essentially, you know, giving an opportunity for a proven liar to disinform the public, not only about crucial issues to democracy, but about public health that are literally costing people their lives in many cases. So that's something that certainly needs to change as well. You know, in the bigger picture, I think we also need to really reframe the debate, because people who value democracy have been waging nonstop defensive battles against one disenfranchisement scheme after another, whether it's purging voter rolls of likely progressive voters, whether it's disenfranchising people through technical issues. We need to figure out a proactive strategy to be able to make sure that voting rights are strengthened and ultimately, I would say, enshrined in the Constitution. Because we have a Supreme Court that's demonstrated time and time again that we cannot rely on them to safeguard voting rights, that it's up to us to take that kind of long-term structural change to embed a right to vote in the Constitution and not subject it to the whims of any temporary majority on the Supreme Court.
So with respect to the elections that are yet to happen, I understand something like half the country, half the states in the country have yet to vote. With the dropping out of the race by Bernie Sanders, the presidential nominee races are for both the Republicans and the Democrats are essentially a done deal. There are, of course, other races that are on those ballots. Do you have any sense of how these other primary races that are yet to take place will play out in the backdrop of this, with this pandemic still looming over us for months on end?
It's really tough to predict. I mean, hopefully with a little bit more time, other states will do a better job than Wisconsin. You know, Wisconsin was the only state in the past 3 weeks that had an election scheduled that went ahead with it rather than postponing it. But we also need to be setting our sights on November and making sure that there is universal opportunity for mail-in voting, that it be done automatically, not having to request a ballot, that it may be postage paid envelopes, so there's not an effective poll tax. And folks really need to be paying attention to that right now, because November is not that far off in terms of planning to put measures in place to make sure we actually have free and fair elections. Certainly would encourage folks who are interested to check out the plan that Elizabeth Warren published earlier this week, that offers some very good guidelines on voting rights. On our website, reclaimdemocracy.org, along with the article published on the Wisconsin elections, there are some resources that address that as well. But encourage folks to really get informed about what's needed and start speaking up about having universal voting in November.
Yeah, let's talk in a little bit more detail about that, because when the coronavirus pandemic was declared, one of the first things that went through my mind was, our incumbent president, who's already joked about serving, a third and a fourth term, and who's clearly demonstrated over and over again that he will bend rules, break rules and laws in order to stay in power, will likely use this disaster that's unfolding as a reason to illegitimately cling to power. And so now what is what's really needed for the November election is a massive expansion of vote by mail. Should we not assume that the coronavirus will be a serious enough issue by November and plan as such?
Absolutely. We need to plan based on the assumption that voting in person will not be safe, and make sure that absolutely no one is in a position where they need to do that. If by chance we're in the clear by then, and there's an option to for states to be able to offer that option of in-person voting, that's certainly a different scenario, but we need to plan on the expectation that it will not be. And certainly along with, I should say, universal mail-in voting, we also should have an option of greatly extended in-person voting for at least a month or more, where people can walk into an election office in their county, because there are many people in the country, especially on Native American Indian reservations, that do not necessarily have reliable mail service, and where we want to make sure that they have other options as well.
California did this during its primary election with voting places within the county open for, I believe, well over a week before the actual election. Anybody could, within that county, could go into any polling place and cast their ballot. So people were able to do it over the weekend, when ordinarily doing it on a weekday might be tough. There are definitely options. We know it's doable. And yet the option of voting by mail is not even universal, right? Aren't there several states where it's not really an option?
Well, right now there are just four states that actually have universal mail-in voting.
So most states don't have it.
Minority of the states, then we have about another 30 states where you can vote by mail, but you have to request the ballot, even though no excuse is required. And then there are another 10 or so states where you actually need to say, here's my excuse for not being able to come in and cast a vote in person. And those excuses can even be rejected in many states by election officers. So we're a long, long way from where we need to be for November to have that kind of universal, no excuse voting in place.
So what specifically has Senator Elizabeth Warren proposed in her plan for trying to salvage our universal right to vote by this November? I know that there was some attempt to appropriate funds during the economic stimulus package discussions to expand mail-in balloting.
Right. So it's a pretty broad plan that includes a lot of measures specifically to thwart disenfranchisement schemes, as well as proactive measures to make sure that there is universal mail-in voting available. And part of that comes down to money. And unfortunately, the Democratic Party nationally passed the stimulus bill with an absolute sliver of what's needed to actually help the states do universal mail-in voting in the fall. Just $400 million was authorized. Senator Warren estimated $5 billion was necessary. So for the Democrats to go ahead and approve that bill without making sure that that was part of the initial stimulus package, I would say was a huge mistake, and hopefully one that won't be made a second time, because there's clearly going to be a need for additional funding to fund the SBA small business loan program, for example, that already is out of money because side issue, but that was opened up to a lot of large corporations that are certainly not small businesses. Those funds are going to run out imminently, and so there will be a lot of pressure on Congress to come back and pass more funding. Democrats absolutely need to make sure that adequate election funding is part of any second round of stimulus funding.
In your opinion, are the Democrats fighting hard enough to make this ensure that our right to vote is properly protected? I mean, according to the Republicans, it's only Democrats who benefit from universal right to vote. I mean, it's just kind of strange even saying those words, because it would be nice to assume that all Americans respect that right, in particular people who are actually elected officials. But Democrats who rely on a more diverse voter base and younger people being able to cast ballots, are they fighting hard enough for this?
Certainly not, in my view. And, having universal voting access is good for democracy. It's not good for a political party. For any elected official to frame this in terms of how we can gain partisan advantage is disgraceful, in my view. But the Democrats have not even come close to doing enough on this front. And, again, think about what happened in Wisconsin. In the reverse scenario, would a Republican governor have simply allowed rural communities across the state to be disenfranchised? I think we all know the answer to that, that they would not bend over and simply meekly accept a ruling that worked against their interests. And Democrats are simply continuing to play wiffle ball while the Republicans play hardball. And when it comes to voting rights, say we need to, and this is one of the things ReclaimDemocracy.org advocates, is working toward an actual constitutional amendment to say voting is an affirmative right, and that we have the right to vote, to have our votes counted equally, and that cannot be taken away at the whim of a state legislature. Because presently, despite all the talk you hear about our right to vote, we actually have no such right. It's simply a privilege that is left up to state governments to grant or deny and control as they see fit.
And the Supreme Court intervening as it sees fit, sadly.
Right, and this has been made clear not just recently, but dating back to 2000 in two separate Supreme Court decisions, Alexander versus Mineta, and then of course Bush v. Gore, where the Supreme Court explicitly said citizens do not have a right to have their vote for the presidential electors. And so we can disagree with the Supreme Court justices and say they're partisan and wrong, but in any case, something as fundamental as voting should not be left to the temporal majority of a Supreme Court. It should be driven into the Constitution, where it is a permanent and inalienable right. So that's what our work at Reclaim Democracy is focused on, is the long-term movement building work to make sure that 10, 20 years from now, voting is a right that will never be taken away from people again.
Well, Jeff, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to your article as well as Reclaim Democracy from our website. Good luck to you.
Thanks so much for having me on tonight.
My guest has been Jeff Milchen, organizer, speaker, and writer, and founder of Reclaim Democracy. We've been discussing Wisconsin's primary race, which took place Tuesday, what it means for the general election in November. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. As Americans adjust to life under quarantine, the daily battle to stockpile enough food has led to serious shortages of staples and a dramatic shift in the way we buy our food. While there are shortages of milk in supermarkets, elsewhere there are reports of dairy farmers being forced to dump thousands of gallons of milk. Food shortages are existing at the same time as excess food production is taking place, exposing the weaknesses of our globalized food systems. Meanwhile, workers on the food chain, from migrant farm workers to truckers, grocery store employees, and delivery drivers, are risking their lives for meager salaries, no paid sick leave, and poor job security to feed us all. My guest is Raj Patel. He's an award-winning writer, activist, and academic, and a research professor at the University of Texas at Austin, also a senior research associate at the Unit for the Humanities at Rhodes University. He's written several books, including Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System, The Value of Nothing, How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy, and A History of the World in Seven Cheap Things, A Guide to Capitalism, Nature, and the Future of the Planet. Welcome to the program, Raj.
It's good to be back with you, Sonali.
So over the many years that I've been talking to you about your various books that I just listed, this issue of the vulnerable food system as it stands right now has come up so often. This bizarre system that has these bottlenecks and this, you know, completely globalized and spread out system of food production. Are you not at all surprised to hear that while people are having trouble buying milk at the supermarket, elsewhere there are dairy farmers dumping milk, or there's just, you know, vegetables that are being forced to rot as people are having a hard time finding food in grocery stores?
No, I mean, Sonali, you're right. I mean, this has been a long time in the making. And in fact, the food system has its fingerprints on the crisis right now. I mean, you know, although we're still in the process of figuring out where COVID came from, it's almost certain that, like other major zoonotic diseases that have emerged in the past 40, 50 years, that there was some relationship between human activity in terms of deforestation and the encroachment of humans into the natural world, and crossing over of diseases jumping from species to species and then entering the food system in the way that it did. But what's bizarre at the moment is the way that different countries are tackling, for example, the fact that there are crops that need to be harvested, but that this entire food system depends in large part on migrant laborers who are desperately underpaid. So for instance, you know, we're hearing stories in Europe of crops rotting. There's German sort of white asparagus harvest that's rotting in the fields right now because migrant workers are not being allowed in, and despite calls from farmers to have citizens come to the fields, not many people are doing it. In France, people are saying, farmers are saying, it's the patriotic thing to do, come join us in the fields and harvest for the people. And to some extent, that's been successfully met by some people who are going out into the fields in France. But in the United States, there's no such call. And instead, in the United States, we have something very different, which is the Trump administration, this is the most xenophobic just straightforwardly anti-immigrant administration, has let in migrant workers, even though the consular outpost for them was closed in Mexico. Migrant workers who were certified to come in under the migrant labor scheme last year have been just reauthorized and allowed to come back in this year, because it would be unconscionable for Americans to think about going to the fields, and we absolutely must have those migrant laborers. And so now in the United States, unlike Europe, there are migrant laborers being brought into the United States to participate in the harvest, but they are vastly unprotected. They are still subject to degrading circumstances and conditions, you know, very little access to hand washing, sometimes in conditions where there are 80 people sharing a single bathroom overnight. And so these are the frontline migrant workers who are, you know, deemed essential and yet whose lives are still being treated as entirely disposable.
And those migrant workers who are at the very beginning of the food chain, you know, we sort of, if we trace how the food gets from its production to where we are, we see, if at all, delivery drivers these days, but we don't see the migrant farm workers. Those are the most invisible workers in the food chain. What would happen if there is an outbreak of coronavirus among migrant farm workers?
For the farm workers at the moment, it's unclear how it is that they would get treatment. There's precious little in terms of access to healthcare already for Americans who are entitled to it in rural areas, and the rural urban divide is going to be made yet more stark through this through the surge of COVID in rural America. So I mean, absolutely, the threat of particularly fresh fruits and vegetables remaining unharvested is a very serious one. And so although America's mechanized commodity crops may continue to be harvested, the work of slaughterhouses, the work of harvesting in the fields, absolutely depends on a workforce that is healthy and is given access to dignity and safety. And unfortunately, we don't have that at the moment.
And explain this idea of commodity crops to our audience, how it can be that we have food insecurity and even starvation happening at the same time that there is excess food being produced.
Well, I mean, the world has been made safe for American crops. So, if we're looking at countries that will in aggregate suffer from the sort of disruptions of the international supply chain, the United States is not among them. Obviously many Americans are going to feel the pain, and we should get to that. But in aggregate, America has enough food. But the kinds of food that America exports are commodity crops like corn, wheat, and soybeans, and these crops are produced through industrial mechanisms that require much less in the way of migrant labor. And in fact, our uses for corn far outstrip the supply of corn is much greater than any individual American can eat. And so that's why in the United States, the single biggest use of our corn harvest is not to eat, not even to feed to animals, but actually to turn into ethanol. So, we're growing so much food, we can set it on fire, and we do. But the sort of corollary of these bulk production commodity crops is that we have a real need for importing other kinds of foods. We've gotten used to sort of countercyclical or tropical commodities so that we can have our coffee and our cocoa and our fresh fruits and vegetables always at the supermarket whenever we want. Those supply chains are much more vulnerable to being disrupted. But in general, the United States has sort of made this world of just-in-time commodity production and of delivery and of countries in the global south paying off their debts by exporting crops to the global north. And that makes the rest of the world much more vulnerable to these supply shocks. So, for example, Malaysia is facing rice shortages in a couple of months if the rest of Southeast Asia stops exporting food to them. And there are less powerful countries that are not able to make the big exporters commit to exporting food, even though they desperately need it. And that kind of world where certain poorer countries are desperately in need of imports and are not certain to get them, that's the world in which we find ourselves as a direct result of U.S. Foreign policy.
Right, because the food system has been set up to maximize profit and not resiliency. But here within the United States, one of the reasons that we're being told that produce is being allowed to rot and milk dumped is because those bulk buyers of food, such as universities and big restaurant chains and college cafeterias have stopped buying the food since the quarantines were put into place. And so instead of finding ways to divert that food, you know, because there's still the same number of people needing to eat it, finding ways to divert that into the supermarket chain system. Instead of doing that, they're letting the food rot, which to me is also just a huge weakness, exposing this huge vulnerability in our national food system as well, right? It's clearly not resilient and able to cope with shocks to the system.
You're exactly right, Sonali. I mean, the irony is that these are these sort of long supply chains have been put in by corporations that say, well, you know, we can't feed ourselves locally and sustainably, and so we must depend on these long supply chains that, you know, stitch together vast suppliers in different parts of the country to vast demand. And as soon as one part of that chain gets knocked out, of course, we have this sort of cascading failure. And that's a cascading failure that we've been living with for decades. I mean, you know, bear in mind that even before the last recession in 2006, we had about 35 million, 36 million people who were food insecure in the United States. Soon after that recession, we saw 50 million people who were food insecure in the United States. And again, peak harvests, you know, year on year, the food supply was doing well, but doing well despite the fact that no one could afford it. Or you know, more and more families were struggling to be able to afford food in America. Right now, we are certainly seeing food insecurity levels comparable to what happened in 2009, 2010. 50 million Americans who are food insecure seems to me an underestimate. And you know, this is, again, part of a global story. I mean, even before this catastrophe, we had 2 billion people who were food insecure around the world. You know, 850-odd million who were actually malnourished in the way that we understand sort of deep and abiding hunger that lasts for a year. But 2 billion people who were food insecure. And if the United States, with all its wealth, can be profligate and, you know, destroying supplies of food over here, while citizens are going hungry and residents of the United States are going hungry, just think about how bad it is elsewhere in the world. So yes, you're absolutely right. It's an embarrassment and an indictment of this appalling system that even when things were fine, we had tens of millions of Americans who were food insecure, and that's certain to be getting much worse right now. And one of the dangers of the post-COVID sort of recovery is that that will be allowed to persist.
So in the current situation, we've seen one aspect of the food system, which has long been a sort of marginal but bright positive aspect, flourish, which is community-supported agriculture. So farmers markets, small farms, urban farms that have seen a huge spike in demand for you know, food being delivered fresh, straight from its source, or being picked up straight from its source by those people who are going to be eating it. And many farmers markets have stepped up to the plate, especially here in California, where we are based. There was a great article in the New York Times about how some farmers markets have designed and their method of, you know, selling and delivery in a way that suggests that they are much more capable of meeting a shock to the system than a big food system has been. Here in my local city, our local farmers market has set up, you know, online pre-ordering and a very interesting way of people being able to come in, just, you know, not get out of their cars. Everyone's wearing masks, getting their food dumped into the trunks of their car so that it's safe for everybody and not risking people's health. So these systems have been shown to be more resilient and more capable of reacting to this disruption. Do you hope that community-supported agriculture can rise to meet the demand and offer a model for a post-COVID future of our food system?
You're so right, Sonali. I mean, it's here in Austin, Texas, we've started harvesting, and you know, my vegetable box this week came with precisely, you know, just a cornucopia of good, healthy, organic food. And the trouble is that it's expensive. And you're absolutely right that these short supply chains that actually connect local sustainable agriculture to folk in cities, is much more robust, much more resilient, much more committed to the welfare of the community. And there are ways to be able to support folk who can't buy a share in a community-supported agriculture farm for those of us who are able to. And these are really important initiatives and things where it is possible to see a much more robust response coming from these kinds of community-supported agriculture initiatives than are coming from big ag. I've been trying to make the case for community-supported agriculture for decades. The problem is that in terms of the bailout, it's not community-supported agriculture initiatives that have the capacity to access the Fed for direct, bond sales, for instance. The way that this stimulus package has been set up is not one that supports these robust supply chains. In fact, quite the opposite. It's the manufacturers of ultra-processed food who are going to be first in line to be relieved of their debts and their obligations, whereas small community-supported, community-run, community-accountable organizations are way at the back of the line in terms of being able to support their staff. And that is a moment of politics that we have to embrace right now. It's entirely possible that we will cruise into a world in the future that looks very much like a situation you and I are familiar with, of sort of the Indian model, where the 1% get food delivered to their door if they can afford it, and then everyone else has to eat ultra-processed rubbish that's available by dint of large-scale subsidy. But we don't want that stratified and unjust and deeply unequal society. But the only way we avoid that kind of a fate is by action and activism. And one of the things that's been very heartening about this moment, bleak as it is that the workers who are essential, the ones that you've listed, everyone from the grocery worker to the janitor to the migrant farm worker, that there is militancy coming from everywhere, from the fields to the checkout, that offers a moment for us to think not just about what it is that must never happen again, but what it is that we need to build a resilient and just and robust food system. I think I'm very excited about that.
Now, in times of no coronavirus, whenever there have been debates about, say, the farm bill here in the U.S., the issue of subsidies to big agriculture often comes up. And isn't there a worry that this moment will be seized by big corporations, including big agricultural corporations, to demand greater taxpayer subsidies without actually offering much in return to benefit ordinary Americans? Shouldn't we be demanding a major change, a permanent change to the way in which we support agriculture at large? Because this country, setting aside the rest of the world for a minute, this country is capable of feeding the people that live on it through local agriculture.
Well, that's absolutely right. But that only happens if we are militant. Mm-hmm. Because here are the two scenarios that that I can see happening. One is exactly as you say, that big ag will affix itself more to the teat of public subsidy. And worse than that, the big ag will be able to say, look, all of this happened because of unregulated farmers markets in China. And so what we need is standardization, and we need the kinds of health and safety regulation that allow us to bleach chickens and allow us to industrialize the process of sanitizing and killing the life around our food products. We need more ultra processing, not less. And so these farmers markets, they're very pretty and everything, but they're not going to solve the problem. In fact, they are the problem. We must eliminate them. And by bringing in food safety regulation that actually is incredibly onerous for sustainable agriculture, the big ag players will choke precisely what it is that we need to be allowing to flourish right now. The other way to go, though, is to follow the lead given to us by everyone from the National Family Farm Coalition to members of La Via Campesina, the International Peasant Movement, to the Food Chain Workers Alliance, and the members of the Food Chain Workers Alliance. You can find them at foodchainworkers.org. There is an amazing range right now of actions and activists who are pushing for this vision. And it is only by demanding the justice from the food from the government for food system workers and for the food system in general that we will get what we want. because otherwise, as you say, it's not hard to imagine who it is has the ear of the Trump administration, and it's certainly not local farmers and farmers markets.
I just also want to mention, as we close our conversation, you know, while there is this huge food shortage and insecurity, the fact that there are millions of Americans every week because of this coronavirus losing their jobs means that there are millions of Americans who aren't seeing paychecks coming in and who are likely going to be unable to feed themselves. Congress is now just now talking about expanding food stamps, but the severe food insecurity that Americans are experiencing and the overloading demands on food banks is basically a crisis waiting to happen. Again, at the same time that there's excess food elsewhere that is going to waste, there are people currently experiencing food insecurity and starvation in this country, you know, that are just being forgotten about by the government, right?
That's right, Sonali. I mean, there is a dignified emergency in America, and the emergency of hunger is one that was going to be compounded by the Trump administration, that was going to stick to the idea of cutting people off SNAP entitlements, the entitlements to be able to get food aid, and it was only because of the short extension that's been built into the stimulus package that wolf is being kept from the door. But there's no guarantee that that's going to continue. So we need to meet this dignified emergency. You know, if you can donate to your local food bank and community food center, please do. But there is the bigger emergency of asking the question, why is it that so many million Americans rely on food banks? And once we solve that problem, we will address poverty and injustice in this country. And that's the bigger fight.
Well, Raj, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Sonali. Thank you for the invitation and for the work you're doing.
My guest has been Raj Patel. He's an award-winning writer, activist, and academic. He's a research professor at the University of Texas at Austin and a senior research associate at the Unit for the Humanities at Rhodes University. He's written a number of books about our food system, including Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System. We've been discussing how the pandemic has exposed the weaknesses of our current food system. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RUWithSonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RUWithSonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
1, 2, 3, 4. Y'all ready for this?